Hi, my name is Chip Spear, and you're listening to Earth Plus 30. Today's guest is a fascinating guy by the name of Tom Strumalo, who's been involved in the energy conservation field for decades. I've known him even a little longer than that. Tom has been at the forefront in many areas of energy efficiency, building retrofitting, data analytics, energy audits, getting involved in those areas long before anybody else. In fact, Tom was instrumental in developing a lot of techniques that today we think of as absolutely normal and a part of everyday life. He's got two Yale degrees, and he's worked on over 10,000 buildings. He's got a database of information that covers everything that he's ever done, plus a lot more. He knows more about energy than many of us will ever know in our lives. And I think that you'll find this conversation with him to be quite eye-opening, quite an education in and of itself. With that, I want to introduce you to Tom Strumalo. Tom, hello.
Hi, Chip. How are you?
Oh, feeling great today. It's a beautiful day here.
Beautiful day, Sunday morning.
Yep, Sunday morning. The perfect time to do this, too.
That's a pretty good summary, I'd say.
Yeah, so tell the listeners a little bit about how you got involved in this and your background, and then we'll talk about the larger problem of energy waste.
Perfect. Yeah, so the last time we were hanging out together a lot was the early 70s at Yale. I've been sort of technically trained, and I think the other important thing about my upbringing was mostly I preferred outdoors to indoors.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time I got to college, I was thinking of writing. I thought maybe getting better at explaining stuff would be a more valuable tool than traveling down the engineering or technical road, which I think I was aiming for coming out of high school. That sort of changed. So I left college thinking I wanted to get involved with environmental issues, and I thought the best way to do it with my skill set was to become a speechwriter. I got a job at the brand new Environmental Protection Department in Hartford right after Yale. They were going to use me to write a newsletter and do some of the environmental ghostwriting for then Governor Grasso in Connecticut. So that, as you will remember, was 1974.
Right.
And by the time I kept painting houses over the summer because I was making good money at it, and it was going to be a huge pay cut to go to work for the Environmental Protection Department. But before I even got to Hartford from New Haven, there was the first Arab or OPEC oil embargo. You know, the state and the country were in sort of energy disarray for the first time, major price increases, fuel shortages. I got to Hartford and they said, well, we're actually sending you over to the energy agency. And I thought, well, I don't know. It seemed like it was part of the environmental mix. So I said, fine, and got over there. And in fact, I was writing, I was answering mail, I was answering the energy mail for the commissioner, and eventually answering the mail for the governor and ghostwriting energy related stuff. And so it was kind of working out as I envisioned. That turns out I was more technically competent than anybody else in that division that had a pretty strong background in basic engineering, but especially physics. And I kind of became the chief engineer just without trying, and got involved with the more technical discussions going on at the time. And as a result of that, I met some interesting people and eventually kind of created an energy audit with a couple of professors from the University of Maine who, I can't even remember their names now, sadly, but we created a sort of a data collection and analysis system on a house that a reasonably competent HVAC guy or, you know, soon to become energy auditor can handle pretty easily. And the whole concept was, let's go to the house and we sort of measure everything and take energy stock. We can provide information, critical information to the owner occupant that will protect them against basically false claims. And so it was really more of a consumer protection thing.
So what do you mean by that, by false claims? Claims for
what?
Yeah,
so I'll give you a good example of that. We got a call one time when I was still working for the state from a woman who said that she'd had six different vendors come over to her house and offer to save her 20% on her electric bill.
Mm-hmm.
And she was confused because six times 20 was 120%. How could that really be?
Right.
And I think that was it. There was a there were a lot of, and nobody was being, I don't think evil about it, but the insulation people were running around going, you know, fill your attic with fiberglass. And the heating and cooling guys were saying new furnace, new controls. Consumers were having a little bit of a trouble figuring out which to do and whether, which made the most sense for them, what they could, if they had limited funds, what they would do.
So can I just interject or ask you another question about this? Because the idea of an energy audit at that time seemed to be a pretty new thing, right?
Yes. And so it caught on like wildfire, actually, because I had a little bit of a personal hand in it. But basically, there was this momentum to say this seemed like a basic consumer right. You ought to have access to the basic energy information enough to be able to make these good, clean, and cost-effective decisions.
So what about that? What about the overlying problem, not just for an individual, but put that in context. Like, what kind of problem is there with energy waste in people's homes so that listeners can get some idea of what you were dealing with at that particular time, and then maybe look at it today, you know, what changes have happened as a result?
Good point. So our analysis at the time was, you know, if there were 50 million houses in the United States, at any given time, you know, 90% of them, 95% of them were existing. And the idea of building new energy efficient houses has always been a great idea, but just didn't add up to a lot of the stock. So retrofitting buildings to be energy efficient became the science. Every single building that I've ever been to, and even today, has room for improvement. There are no zero energy houses, and technology is constantly changing and improving. But at the time, anytime we made a categorical or a scientific look at things, we saw a pretty easy 25 or 30% savings.
25 to 30% savings in energy. That's a pretty astoundingly high number.
And that was, we were able to do that cheap. I mean, we wanted to spend some serious money on things like new windows or solar, hot water, or solar electric, expensive technology. Most buildings, even today, could probably reduce their footprint, you know, their energy footprint by 50% or more, which are numbers that actually that persist today.
Right.
We've made some progress, and, you know, after my early years with the energy audit in residences and multifamily housing, I got involved in commercial industrial properties and still continue to go building by building and still finding pretty much everywhere the same opportunity for savings.
Mm-hmm. So overall, if we look at the United States as one example, what kind of energy waste are we talking about, or what kind of savings would we recognize or realize, I should say, if we implemented an energy audit and changes or whatever throughout the entire country? Let's say, what if it was perfect and we fixed every building? How much would we save?
Yeah. I think percentages, again, are sort of easier than the gross. But
okay. Just to get an idea.
So I looked at the numbers. Looks like the savings is somewhere close to $100 billion a year.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
If we took on the bulk of the remaining, extremely inefficient commercial industrial buildings in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe more important, energy is a great common denominator, and it's worked well in that capacity in my life, in my professional life. The happy coincidence is that everything we do about making buildings more energy efficient is reducing CO2 from combustion in the atmosphere. The holy grail would be to stop current levels of CO2 pollution, you know, have them and back them down to some reasonable number where, you know, the residual pollution doesn't continue to sort of overcook the atmosphere. That a project where we took on in this country 1 million commercial industrial buildings and just cut energy usage by about on average 30% across that spectrum would actually move the carbon needle.
Hey, can I interrupt you for a minute?
Yeah.
You got a lot of background noise. I don't know if you're moving around or something's moving around, but
Yeah, that dog is.
Yeah, it's making a lot of noise. So
Okay, it's on the mic. Can we pause for a sec? Let me wrap up that sort of ramble about carbon a little more succinctly.
So Tom, tell me a little bit about the impact that this has on a larger context, like perhaps the United States. What kind of savings might we realize, or what kind of impact could this potentially have?
So the detailed answer to that question is that the stakes are extremely high. I did on an envelope an analysis of if we made it our mission similar to going to the moon, to retrofit at whatever cost 1 million American commercial industrial buildings. And I figured if we really put our shoulder to the wheel, we would do that in less than 5 years, hopefully close to 2 years. And that the numbers suggest we could save about $10,000 a year on electricity and gas in those buildings apiece, which if you did the math is $10 billion a year in savings, and obviously an equivalent amount of electricity or natural gas unused, and a one-for-one relationship with CO2 as a result of combustion.
Wow, $10 billion a year. And what would the cost be to actually implement that, to do the studies, to get those buildings retrofitted?
Yeah, I did that again a little bit on the back of the envelope, but there have been some pretty sophisticated studies along these lines, sort of setting the table for opportunity. And for that, they were thinking an equivalent. We also think that kind of payback, those kind of savings would have a 3 year or less payback, which means if it costs us three times that amount to do, we'd have our money back in 3 years, which is be pretty astonishing. You can see why I get frustrated why this hasn't really caught on.
If you're talking about a $10,000 per building savings on an average, that the cost would be roughly $30,000.
That's right.
To retrofit, and you'd realize that back in 3 years, and then you'd be making all sorts of money after that. That $10,000 a year, right?
Yeah. Those numbers are sometimes higher than that. And they tend to sort of stretch the payback out to more, say, 4 or 5 years, all still good money.
Right.
That's because most of the studying in this field with the looking at the gross opportunity.
Right.
I mean, it's looking at more the gross opportunity than the gross savings. That you can see if you could start turning over $30 billion in building improvement contracting.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of people will be making money, and I think the people doing the retrofits deserve to be making the money. The question is how much of those savings we want to just give to unnecessary levels of either advice or brokerage. So that's one of the hurdles we have today is we want to get to this million buildings, say, and we want to get to it fast, but there are a lot of layers. There's somebody from three or four different consulting groups involved, I mean, per building, the utility company, the oil company, maybe a second utility company for natural gas, and any number of vendors on hand. So a lot of moving parts.
That's one of the things that I've been struck by in a number of my conversations with people that are in this effort. And that is that there are many different layers that need coordinating, and that there's nobody that is stepping up or no organization that is helping organize and implement or get this stuff implemented. So there's no real facilitator, right? That's a role that the government certainly has not been playing recently, it seems to me. And I don't know if we need to leave that to private marketplace or there's some combination that needs to happen, but it definitely is coming up again and again in my conversations with people like you about problems like this. It's a huge issue.
Yeah, that's putting your finger right on it, Chip. It has been a long time for me. I'm just entering my 43rd year in this business.
Mm-hmm.
It puts me in rarefied air with people willing to sort of slug it out this long.
Right.
But I think my combination of experience and perspective is useful. And the simplest way to look at it is that we never just made a list of the buildings and then worked our way down the list and just checked off the ones we've done at least the first round of work on, and then gotten to the bottom and then maybe started again. And now we have some new buildings to add to it. But there's been no real categorical effort to coordinate this effort. And it's been allowed to kind of, I think, because a lot of self-employed and small companies have been providing energy audits, energy consulting. You know, we create a lot of jobs in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And the big consulting groups and big energy service companies as well, very powerful in the marketplace. Everybody looking for a little bit of market share. It seemed okay to us as a whole to sort of have this little business, you know, spreading and growing a little bit. The thing is, really ramping it up, which the last time this happened in the government was President Obama
mm-hmm.
in 2009, dumped a whole bunch of money into this and into energy efficiency and solar. And it actually took some grief for it, but that was a widespread, national effort to kind of get this thing organized and going. We had some very powerful, competent people at the Department of Energy at the time. So there was some sign that, we were finally pulling this together into a better organized effort. Yeah, we've reversed that ground recently on the one hand. But on the other hand, these processes of technology retrofits, improving our building envelopes and controlling them, and then adding, say, solar to them, those costs have all dropped precipitously. So that what owners and building owners need to know now is that you don't have to wait around for somebody to stop by from the utility company saying there's an incentive for this. This is all cheap in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to call a guy and say, fix my building.
Right.
I think from that perspective,
mm-hmm.
people don't typically think about energy and call a guy. Almost anything else in their operations lines, they might pick up and call about. But this one has been poorly explained, and I think maybe a little bit of geeky speak. We've created this language, which BTU is the...
Right. What is that? Right.
Exactly. The British Thermal Unit.
Yeah, like what?
You know what it is? It's the amount of energy that comes off of an old wooden match head.
Right. So tell me, I wanted to ask a couple of specific things, because you have seen technology change a great deal over your life in this field. What is different today that you're using as opposed to what you were doing, 30, 40 years ago? So that people are excited, because there are all these new technologies that come on the market, and I'm sure that many of the new technologies are being applied to this area of retrofitting buildings and doing audits and that sort of thing. How is that helping the consumer?
Yeah, so that's a terrific question. Three things happen in the modern building retrofit. The first is that we've gotten pretty good at these sort of behavioral adjustments, which you might remember energy efficiency was originally called energy conservation. Mm-hmm. During the Carter administration, it was meant to mean you have to give something up, and efficiency has nothing to do with that. Efficiency really has more to do with, on the positive side of behavior, developing better habits. I'm somewhat of a fan of that, but the idea of being able to scare people into making their building run more efficiently is a long shot for me. It works for a time, and then there's blowback. But that behavioral thing is a real piece of the pie today. And that includes all the education and social media conversations and all these things that really have helped get the message across.
Mm-hmm.
The other two things are modern technology for heating, cooling, and running the place. And then there's the structure itself. So, the Nest thermostat, these fancy thermostats that homeowners and commercial building owners can play with when they're on vacation.
No, I play with it all the time. We have one in the house, as a matter of fact.
Exactly.
Yeah. It works great, by the way.
But also, you can hire a computer to run your HVAC now. Mm-hmm. They call it machine to machine, or the Internet of Energy things. So I think that's been That's exciting. I think the behavioral stuff is sort of interesting. The thing that we're dragging our feet on is this idea of making the vessel itself, the building, tighter, with better insulation, less heat loss, less cooled air loss, and but proper ventilation for healthy residents or occupancy. And that's the one. I mean, that's the biggest expense and the biggest challenge, and the part where I think we need the most high level of coordination through the government. The last thing I'll say about the building it. So here's a picture for you. We like to see how tight a building is by picturing taking it out in the ocean and tipping it upside down and seeing how fast it sinks, like cracks in the hull.
Right.
That is in a whole different category almost than retrofit. That's in infrastructure. I think we need help from big banks and the government. We have to take on those buildings, say, by the neighborhood or the city or some sort of unit besides whoever signs up for it. For that kind of big dollar expenditure, I think that list that I've been talking about is a little bit different.
Well, it makes me think about Death by a Thousand Cuts. And I say that because there are whole sections of buildings in cities or wherever, every place, that are old and inefficient, but there's no organization that could really take control of fixing those buildings. So most people would say, hey, that's not my problem. That's somebody else's problem. And that somebody else might not either be aware or not have the money or not be aware of any program that they could take advantage of that would help them with special financing. So it does lead me to think, well, who is helping these people? They could be building owners or apartment building owners that just aren't thinking about that in the same way. And trying to get that message across seems to me to be instrumental, absolutely essential in implementing any of the changes overall or holistically that you're advocating.
Yeah, I'm an efficiency, in some ways an efficiency expert, but think things need to be efficient generally. And but this is one case where I think we might need another organization. So historically, here's we sort of hope the utility companies would become our energy companies and take on with enthusiasm this idea of making the buildings that they serve more efficient. And that's happened. There's a full spectrum of how well that's sort of evolved over the last 4 decades. Some utilities have taken their responsibility on the efficiency side very seriously and have actually, made great progress with their list of buildings. And a couple places, especially in New York State, a couple of states, well, almost the same in Connecticut and New Jersey, and definitely the way in California, a separate nonprofit was set up with money that the utility companies are either penalized or that they collect from shareholders or ratepayers. And this pool of energy retrofit funding is available. If that's well managed, New York State, as their nonprofit, NYSERDA, has done as well as anybody in the country about taking the lead on this, spreading the word, creating, leveraging funds through cost-effective programs. And they come as close as anybody to having this list, and they're working their way down it. And Connecticut has a green bank with a lot of those responsibilities, although a fairly weak energy office. New Jersey has great energy incentives. California is like a different country. And then there are states where nobody's doing anything, and at the other end of that spectrum.
Now, why do you think that is? They don't care. I would think that everybody would care about trying to save money.
Well, I think cheap power is the number one thing. And then there's a massive political difference, this concept, which I had some friends from Austria tell me that they thought it looked like energy efficiency was a democratic thing in the United States.
What do they mean by that? Well, I don't
Yeah,
understand.
versus Republican, meaning it looked like the blue states would get it and the red states wouldn't. It's a little bit,
That's
it's more
fascinating.
complicated than that, but in fact, I mean, I told you, I think I might have mentioned once before, I did a stint in Nebraska where we went door to door and introduced with the money to do the retrofits right there in our hands. And the first question out of everybody's mouth to us was, "Are you Democrats?"
Really?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of that. It seems like your idea is, use up the coal till it's gone, in these big power plants and burn the hottest fire you can to make your power. And when we're done with that technology, we'll go on to something else. Someone stopping by and saying, you should really get storm windows just doesn't resonate. They're
Even
it's
when
like
they
what?
realize they're going to save a lot of money, if you come up to them and
Yeah,
say, you
absolutely.
know, if you switch and put in these other windows, which are going to cost you X amount of dollars, you're going to be able to save Y dollars, which is substantially more within
Yeah.
2 to 3 years. And
So, yes.
they're thinking about politics rather than their own pocket. That seems curious.
I think it's an unfortunate reality that's, but part of this, what we are talking about right now is how do we reframe that message and who's,
Right.
should it be me going there in the first place? Obviously, if it was the utility representative going to them instead of a third party, even though we were engineers or, technical consultants, that message would have a little bit more impact.
So how do you approach the energy companies or the utility and get them to partner with you to do exactly what you're suggesting?
Well,
And
I think
it's
there is some of that going on, but I think your question is more like across that wide range of utilities, attitudes, building types, weather conditions, and all that stuff. How can we tie all those different markets together into an organized whole? And if we are going to make this master list of building, keep picturing this master list of all the American buildings that need to be retrofitted, working our way down the list, how do we do it? So I think we've tried breaking our country up by utility company that we have worked on really hard for decades, and it's just not good enough. There's dramatic, technical and financial, technical, financial and attitudinal differences, much more state by state than by utility. And so I think the best solution from my perspective these days is to use a central clearinghouse that's the knowledge base and probably the financial base, but then to go downstream state by state with representatives from the Senate, from the headquarters that are familiar with that particular market and have created that particular message that'll make the difference. And the only other subdivision I put under that is there's then just going to be another break within the state to city versus suburban and rural. And it's just a different set of skills and messages with, some other opportunities, I think, at the same time.
Well, it's interesting because I spoke to two other people, one by the name of Steph Spears. She's co-founder of a company called Solstice that's based in the Boston area and helps people gain access to solar farms. And the other is a gentleman by the name of Bill Jorgensen, who is with the company named Vanguard Renewables, and they build power plants that are tied to farms, and they use organic materials, manure and compost that they burn. And
Yeah,
they're
methane.
highly, highly, yeah, methane, essentially. But the thing that both of them said is that the biggest problem they have is working with the local authorities and the utility companies who are not particularly open, welcoming them with open arms, and the fact that every state has its own individual organization or government regulations that create a huge number of problems and is incredibly complicated and to navigate so that anybody who's trying to make an impact on a larger scale has to navigate every single state and many county regulators in order to make an impact. That's hard.
Yeah, I'd say that's creating something with a powerful central organization with a massive energy database and with online engineering capability. It's not going to be the country, which it's just not, especially for the next few years, and but really ever.
Why do you say
It does
that?
set up.
What do you think,
It
just
sets up.
because politically?
Well, I think that the Yeah, I think that this sort of partnership between public and private will end up spelling the success. You have these great ideas, which you can have in Washington, D.C., or I could have here in my office and then just reach out with an army of people to take the messages to the various states and then to the individual buildings. I think it's a lot more like Teach for America or a grassroots soccer organization,
in what way?
In the sense that we need eager and interested and articulate, maybe fun people making the final delivery. We don't want to send them to engineering school. We want to spread the message and pass out the money that's all available by people familiar with the neighborhood who have fun and suffer right along with the people that they're talking to. But that works if the back end is so robust that our engineering capability, our price estimating, our access to funds is centralized enough to be able to sort of lobby with strength with all the utilities and Department of Energy, and then of course the large manufacturers and vendors to tie it. So I mean, I think we've tried for long enough to have it sort of government inspired. And I think it has to be, I think it should be a nonprofit, although somebody like Honeywell decide to do this themselves. You know, they're in all the markets and they have guys in every neighborhood.
Yeah. But,
I really think that there's a communications system requiring face-to-face conversations about this topic.
So can I switch gears a little bit and take another view and get your opinion on what's going on internationally in the same vein in Europe or in emerging developing countries? Do you have any contact or view of what has happened and what works or what doesn't overseas?
Yes. So the model for widespread, interruptible, or distributed energy supply, meaning basically photovoltaic solar, was created and matured in two places, really, Germany and then Hawaii in the United States, where with some system of incentives and education and public policy, these two markets installed more solar power than they could actually use. Again, that's on the supply side, and they've come up against these technical issues, which aren't complicated, but there are more required technical solutions. But they now have to create storage for all that extra solar to stay in a battery pack until it's needed. That storage capacity is actually all the utilities everywhere in the world's latest headache, but point of focus. And I have no doubt that that issue is not, it's not a problem. It's technically already been solved. Now we just got to get a lot of batteries out there. But that model is one that Germany especially sort of were on the supply train. Basically, they said, we're going to go solar. We're going to use it to replace our nukes and our coal plants. And, we're going to go hog. I mean, they focused almost exclusively for about 8 years on their solar project. At the end of that, they said, we skipped right over energy efficiency and created a new national effort to now go back and make all the buildings more efficient, even though they've got this new solar power. Still, if they make their buildings more efficient, they'll have less nighttime requirements. Sun's not sun shining. And right. So typically in German, they sort of put together the same sort of Marshall plan of retrofitting their buildings that you and I have been talking about.
Yeah.
At the national level.
They did.
And they're cramming it down.
Wow. Or is Germany exporting that approach to help other countries do the same thing?
Well, we adopted that model a little bit in this country. We sort of followed Germany saying, oh, wow, it looks like you really can roll this solar thing out. I think Germany is not the land of sunshine. So the real excitement was that the U.S. went, oh, I can see. It's not, we don't need Arizona for this. All we really need is high electricity costs. And so that's why California always had them, and they were out ahead on this whole solar thing. Hawaii, an island, notorious for egregiously high electricity costs. And now Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, and New York are actually the highest costs in the U.S., and they're all states that have gone in hog wild on solar as well.
So
the important issue, though, is that that solar model will work on the efficiency side. So I think they really pushed it. They pushed the envelope and gave us a picture of how things how we can actually make these sort of high level decisions and then get it into the marketplace and let it sort of scramble its way to success. Chip, let me give you another, try to be quick, a quick example. Ireland looked at this energy efficiency problem and said, you know what? We have to take on the cost of that as a society. And they did about a 2-year deal, and I think it was 50,000 houses.
Wow.
Where they just loaded up trucks with all the energy retrofit equipment, insulation, new programmable thermostats, weather stripping, LED light bulbs. And they just went down the street building by building. And they literally, their marketing plan was to go to the door, knock on the door and say, we're here to fix your house up to be more energy efficient. Can we come in? And people would say, yeah, sure. And then they'd go to the next one. And there was an idea where they just put everything behind the curtain. You know, it was this one point of contact. Yes or no? Yes.
Right.
Done. Check it off.
Man, I can see all sorts of problems with trying to implement that in the United States, but it sounds like a great idea. People would be up in arms. What do you mean? You're just coming and walking in the door? Who said you could do that? How was that done?
I think you can get past that, but right. I think we're a little more nervous. If it wasn't the electric company, which is so our original idea, and you can read about this in my book, Decentralizing Electricity Production, 1983.
I was going to ask about that book. So good that you mentioned book, that.
We actually said, you know, what would work is if your electric utility company truck pulled up and said, you know, yes, we're giving you supply, but we also want to reduce your demand. We're here to make your house more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
That was our original plan. That was everybody's original plan. That one energy company would take the demand side as well as the supply side. And it's really worked marginally well at the very best, you know, over the 4 decades of trying to talk them into it. And that's why I say I'm tired of going there and beating my head against the wall. I think a different energy organization and probably nonprofit really needs to kind of take this, you know, come in between the building owners and the utilities and the government and the vendors and be the person to sort of broker, you know, good information, cheap prices, and just get the job done.
Essentially, you're looking for an organization to act as a facilitator and pull all these various pieces together so that they're harmonized and working in concert so that everybody is benefiting and that nobody's really losing.
I think that's where my company's going. I mean, that's without somebody else stepping up with a bunch of money to help, sort of my last rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what I'd like to see if I can create that model, you know, on my own for not very much money, create the sort of the blueprint at the very least, which I'm doing. I'm lucky enough to be working at, as you know, colleges and universities now.
Mm-hmm.
I have interns at each, and at Florida Gulf Coast University in specific, I've got an intern that I'm giving basic training to and then sending her out with the tools and keep her tethered to our offices in Southwest Florida where we've got the databases for that market.
Uh-huh.
We'll provide her the financing and technical background, and she'll go make the point of contact, and we'll sort of test out how the conversation goes. She's the sort of Florida young woman, you know, born and bred. She speaks the language. She's likable, and she's interested, and we're going to sort of test this theory there, of which I'm doing the same thing every other year at the Yale Forestry School and currently at Vassar College.
Well, Tom, this all sounds incredibly exciting, ripe with a lot of possibilities. I don't want to take up too much more of your time here, but I think that you really outlined some great issues, some very practical solutions, and a roadmap toward the future that I think is doable with the right input. And maybe somebody listening to this will be interested enough to reach out and contact you or me, and we can get something like that off the ground that really starts to generate those sorts of changes. So I just want to ask you one last question. In a couple of sentences, if you were to look 30 years down the road, my Earth plus 30, what would your vision be for this? What kind of change do you think will happen and needs to happen?
I gave a lecture once on why an energy analyst, energy auditor, energy consultant ought to be looking forward to the day that he or she goes out of business. Yeah, and this slice of the pie, making our buildings more efficient. And we've got good new building codes. So the new buildings coming along are in pretty good shape. I really think that we'll either 30 years from now, we either sort of dug in and fixed all of our buildings, and we therefore have sort of reduced the need to even have conversations like this much anymore,
mm-hmm.
and are breathing nice, clean air, or we never got the message and we're still wallowing around and our problems are bigger, which is that we've 30 years from now, I sense that with current levels of combustion pollution, we have great portions of the earth that are almost uninhabitable, and our children and grandchildren are going to have some pretty serious problems.
Right. That's good to hear. Thank you. I think you really laid out what we're facing and what we need to do to fix these problems. So, Tom, I want to thank you very much for your time and the information. I hope people find this interesting and useful. And with that, I'm going to say goodbye. Thanks again.
Thank you, Chip.
Thanks for listening today. Do you have an idea for a podcast? Let me know. Visit my website. You can contact me there or send me an email at chip@earthplus30.com. Until next time, this is Chip Spear.